Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Carl Canetta, co-director at the Project on Defense Alternatives, who discusses a recent study conducted by his organization estimating between 11,000 and 15,000 Iraqis were killed during the early stages of the Iraq War. Dr. Steffi Woolhandler, co-founder of Physicians for a National Health Program, who describes an important shift in public opinion, which now supports the establishment of a government-run universal health insurance program. And Sean Cosgrove of the Sierra Club, who explains why many environmentalists oppose congressional legislation directed at forest fire prevention, such as those that have recently ravaged large parts of California. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
A new report commissioned by the United Nations Children's Fund, or UNICEF, estimates that more than a billion children across the globe live in severe poverty, without easy access to food, water, or sanitation. The UNICEF report, the first global attempt to scientifically document world poverty, says the gap between rich and poor nations is growing due to the push for free markets and cuts in international development aid. In 2000, the United Nations pledged that within 15 years, it would work to cut in half the number of people who live on a dollar a day or less to survive. But child advocates now doubt that this goal can be reached. As report co-author Shailene Nandy told the Independent newspaper, the result of cutting basic public spending has been to increase poverty and inequality, a fact that organizations like the World Bank must acknowledge. The report was prepared by the Townsend Center for International Poverty Research at the University of Bristol, England. Rising poverty is blamed by advocates like Christian Aid on the drive for open markets, which ironically is causing poor nations to lose income. As a result, social services are cut and families have to pay for health care and education, placing a further burden on poor children. Concerned about its ailing public image, officials at Vice President Dick Cheney's former oil company Halliburton are desperately trying to spin public opinion in their favor. The current CEO of Halliburton, David Lesser, sent a memo to company employees on the topic of defending our company, a copy of which was acquired by the online site misleader.org. The memo asked employees to send letters to newspaper editors in order to be, quote, heard over the voices of those who are distorting our efforts. One of the talking points Lesser mentioned stated that Halliburton was one of the few companies in the world that can do the work needed by the U.S. military. The defensive posture of the company stems in part from a discovery by two members of Congress. Representatives Henry A. Waxman, Democrat from California, and John Dingell, Democrat from Michigan, released a letter from Iraq's National Oil Company stating it pays between 90 and 98 cents per gallon for fuel it imports into Iraq. Halliburton, meanwhile, is charging as much as $1.70 per gallon. The legislators charge that Halliburton is gouging the U.S. Treasury. Even though Halliburton's Kellogg, Brown & Root Engineering and Construction Unit paid $2 million to settle a criminal charge for overbilling the government last year, KBR was awarded another federal contract in March to extinguish Iraqi oil fires. While President George Bush has not commented directly on Halliburton's cost overruns or PR campaign, he has said in the past that corporate leaders who violate the public trust should never be given that trust again. But then, Halliburton has a special relationship with the Bush administration. For 15 years, National Park Service biologist John Meyer has worked to protect fish habitats in the Olympic Peninsula in Washington State from the harmful legacy of old dams and clearcutting. Based on Meyer's work, two old dams in Washington's Elwha River will be breached in 2007 to ease the way for salmon runs. Now Meyer's job and thousands of other National Park Service positions are in danger of a Bush administration initiative that aims to privatize 20,000 Park Service jobs. According to Sierra Magazine, politically connected private consultants could pick up new, lucrative contracts. Many longtime Park Service employees oppose the privatization bid. As David Ubaragua, the superintendent of the Mount Rainier National Park, explained, "The Bush plan is the greatest contemporary threat to the park's resources that we face, greater than invasive species or air pollution." The big payoff for the Bush administration could be the new contracts it awards to large engineering companies, usually big donors to the GOP, to build and maintain national parks. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon and Britta Brundage. For Between the Lines, I'm Sasha Summer Cousineau.
The November 2nd shooting down of an American transport helicopter in Iraq, which killed 16 and wounded 20 soldiers, was the most deadly attack on U.S. forces since President Bush invaded Iraq last March. This assault, carried out with a shoulder-fired surface-to-air missile, is just the latest evidence of an escalating guerrilla war being waged against America's occupation army. But despite a campaign carried out by the White House to emphasize all that's positive in occupied Iraq and the Pentagon's dismissal of guerrilla attacks as strategically and operationally insignificant, there is growing concern among the American people and diminished prospects of foreign military assistance. While the increasing number of U.S. soldiers killed and injured in Iraq are duly covered by the nation's media outlets, the press has paid little or no attention to the cost of the U.S. war on Iraqi soldiers and civilians. A new independent report released by the Project on Defense Alternatives in late October estimates that 13,000 Iraqis were killed during the major combat phase of the ongoing war in Iraq. The study found that between 3,200 and 4,300 of the dead were unarmed civilians. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Carl Canetta, co-director at the Project on Defense Alternatives, who summarizes his group's report and explains why he believes it is important for U.S. policymakers to consider how the war's death toll among Iraqis contributes to the ongoing resistance confronting the American occupation.
Our initial interest was motivated by the fact that very few people were doing this work. There is the counting done by bodycount.org, and some others who have done bits and pieces. What we wanted to do was take a closer look and try to discriminate between combatants and non-combatants. No one was really addressing the issue of Iraqi combatants at all. And this, we thought, was a vital piece of information if you're going to develop a security policy in an intelligent fashion. You really can't wage war or for that matter, do anything without attention to the costs. And this is one piece of that equation. Our general thrust is not a casualty counting organization, but this we found to be a piece of information that we needed if we were going to say anything intelligent about the war. So we decided to invest some resources and time in doing this.
Summarize the report, if you would, in terms of your findings about Iraqi civilian and military casualties in this latest war.
Sure. You know, the sources we drew on were principally 500 press reports, and within that large number of press reports, key ones were several hospital and burial society surveys that were done by the L.A. Times, by the AP, and by Knight Ritter reporters, but then a whole vast number of individual incidents, a lot of reports from embedded reporters who gave a view from the battlefield, and probably around 100 estimates made by U.S. military personnel, usually on the smaller unit level, battalions. So these are folks that were close to the battle. That's what we started with. And we applied demographic information to the numbers of civilians to try to get a sense of how many of these civilians were combatants or were non-combatants. And finally, we integrated a lot of information from the Pentagon on the expenditure of weapons, when they were used, where they were used, and we tried to see if there was a correlation between the reports of casualties and the use of weapons. And that helped us decide what were the more plausible, because we always had more than one estimate for any particular incident. Our findings were 11,000 to 15,000 total Iraqi fatalities in the war. That implies a total of 40,000 killed or wounded. Within the number of fatalities, about 30% were non-combatants, which is to say there were civilians who did not take up arms. This does not include civilians who took up arms or military people who put on civilian uniforms. The specific numbers we came up with were between 3,200 and 4,300 civilian non-combatant deaths, and the remainder of the number were Iraqi combatants.
Carl Canetta, tell us why you think it's important for the American people to know the costs in terms of lives and injuries among the Iraqi citizenry. Why is that important, especially in view of the ongoing and increasing resistance to the U.S. occupation?
Sure. I think we all appreciate that, at least historically, war itself is a weapon of mass destruction. And it sends a trauma throughout a society that often backwashes onto the other side. We need to be sensitive to what type of sentiment we leave behind. And in our view, one of the reasons we continue to face difficulty in Iraq is that you have a fairly large constituency of people who have a chip on their shoulder, people who lost family members. This is a society with very strong extended family ties, tribal ties, village ties, so that when someone loses a person, that this is remembered. And it's part of the motivation, we think, if not for the high-profile attacks, which we see, the lower-profile ones that have gone on since May 1st, there have been 3,000 incidents since May 1st of friction and contact and fighting between coalition and local people, that part of that is motivated by people seeking revenge or people who are sensitized, let's say, to the U.S. presence and not that accepting of it. So when we say we won the war easily, but the peace is turning out to be a lot more difficult, those two things are not separate. War is a weapon of mass destruction. It leaves behind a trail of misery. And part of what happens is that misery seeps into the post-war period, and people are acting partly out of revenge.
Is the White House and the Pentagon sufficiently concerned about Iraqi civilian casualties at this moment when so many incidents occur where civilians are killed in the crossfire or by accident, you know, when a car doesn't stop quite soon enough at a checkpoint, et cetera?
As long as you're using the instrument of war, it's hard. I think what we've demonstrated in our study, it's hard to keep civilian casualties down. And if you pursue very ambitious objectives, then the civilian casualties are going to mount. So, you know, I think that the armed forces, they are following orders, but the mission itself is leading us into conflict with broad sectors of Iraqi society.
That was Carl Canetta, co-director at the Project on Defense Alternatives. Contact the project by calling area code 617-547-4474. Or visit their website at www.comw.org/PDA. With an estimated 43 million Americans without health insurance and sharply rising costs each year, there is a new openness to undertake fundamental changes in the nation's healthcare system. In September, 10,000 doctors publicly endorsed the creation of a government-run single-payer healthcare program in the pages of the prestigious Journal of the American Medical Association, or JAMA. And in a Washington Post ABC News poll released in October, a majority of Americans by a 2-to-1 margin now prefer the establishment of a new universal national health insurance system over the current privatized health care structure. The U.S. is the only industrialized nation in the world that doesn't provide its citizens universal health care coverage. But despite growing dissatisfaction with the current system and skyrocketing costs for health care and prescription drugs, politicians at the state and national levels seem unwilling to challenge the current system where big insurance companies and pharmaceutical manufacturers have considerable power to influence the debate through lobbying and campaign contributions. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Dr. Steffi Woolhandler, Associate Professor of Medicine at Harvard University and co-founder of Physicians for a National Healthcare Program, who explains why she believes there has been a shift in public opinion regarding universal health care and the political environment that hinders fundamental reform.
Well, I think if you go out there and talk to the American people, you find tremendous support for national health insurance, and of course that's what the poll showed. If you talk to the medical profession, you find tremendous support, and that's what the recent publication in the Journal of the American Medical Association showed. What's stunning is if you talk to politicians, there's a near silence on the issue of national health insurance, which, with a few notable exceptions, such as Dennis Kucinich and Carol Mosley Brown, the Democrats have been offering up halfway measures, patchwork measures, certainly not offering up the national health insurance that polls are showing the American people support. Well, there's two things pushing us toward change. One, of course, is the number of uninsured Americans. There's 43 million uninsured. The number of underinsured Americans is probably 50 million of those, people with only partial coverage. So that would be one thing pushing us toward change, is the ongoing problems in access to care. But the other big push is the rising costs of health care. We're seeing health care costs go up at 9 or 10% a year in the presence of a cool economy. And many large employers are really feeling that the cost of health benefits for their workers are a major problem in terms of international competitiveness.
Tell us a little bit, if you would, about some of the major corporations. I've heard Ford Motor Company may be among them that is giving more thought to the benefits of a national health care program.
Well, Ford Motors and several of the other smokestack industries are particularly hard hit by high health care costs because they're unionized and they offer a relatively generous health insurance package to their unionized workers. They also have large numbers of retirees, many of whom they're contractually obligated to provide health insurance for. So for people who retire before the age of 65, often the employer, in this case Ford or GM, picks up the cost of the health insurance. So for these reasons, Ford and GM have massive obligations to pay for health insurance. And whenever health care costs go up, it's a major problem for those corporations in terms of meeting those higher costs. The automobile industry is competitive internationally. It's about to become more competitive internationally. And I think Ford and GM rightly feel that unless something's done about health care costs, they're going to be in big trouble in terms of producing cars in the United States. When the big corporations start to say something needs to change, then the debate opens up. And I don't really see Ford or GM or major corporations becoming the champions of a universal nonprofit single-payer health insurance system. But I do see them as facilitating, allowing, encouraging, if you will, an ongoing debate about health care reform. And that kind of debate leaves an opening for persons such as myself who are advocates of national health insurance.
Dr. Wollhandler, what would an American national health insurance program look like? Would it look like anything that we see now in Canada, or in Europe, or Australia?
Well, we call it somewhat jokingly Canada Deluxe. That is, we would like a system with the efficiency of the Canadian system, with the fairness of the Canadian system, but with the higher levels of funding that we're used to in the United States. You know, in the state of Massachusetts, we spend about twice as much on a per capita basis as the Canadian government spends on Canadians. So if we had a Canadian-style system, but with those higher U.S. levels of funding, we could have all the benefits of a Canadian system with none of the shortages or waiting lists that we hear about in Canada. I do want to say those shortages and waiting lists are much exaggerated in the U.S. media and in the U.S. press, but they do in fact exist, and that's because the level of spending in Canada is so much lower than in, for instance, Massachusetts. But so our group advocates maintaining the current level of funding, but using an efficient and fair system like Canada's to distribute that funding.
One of the most powerful opponents of a national healthcare system is, of course, the large insurance companies and pharmaceutical manufacturers. You want to respond to how the large insurance companies might respond to this new wave of popular support for a universal healthcare system?
Well, the insurance companies are completely opposed to national health insurance, and that's because there would really be no role for private health insurance in an efficient national health insurance program. So the administrative savings by getting the insurance industry out of health care are the money you need to provide health care to everyone with no increase in costs. Whether the American people are fully aware of this or not, in fact, the insurance company is completely aware of it and views national health insurance as a life or death struggle for them. They're completely opposed to national health insurance. The insurance company, day in, day out, spends millions of dollars on lobbying, on campaign contributions to make sure that their voice is louder, than the voice of the American people. It doesn't have to be that way. I think if the American people become informed, become mobilized, they can force politicians to listen to what the people want. And according to this ABC poll, the people do want national health insurance.
That was Dr. Steffi Wollhandler, Associate Professor of Medicine at Harvard University and co-founder of Physicians for a National Health Program. To contact Physicians for a National Health Program, call area code 312-782-6006 or visit their website at www.pnhp.org. As wildfires raged across Southern California, the U.S. Senate passed a forestry bill in late October that would relax environmental regulations and limit judicial review on tree thinning projects on 20 million acres of federal lands. Thus far, the fires have claimed the lives of 20 people, burned more than 700,000 acres, an area the size of Rhode Island, and destroyed 3,500 homes. Supporters of the bill say its provisions will both protect old-growth forests and help prevent a recurrence of the devastation to people and property caused by this year's inferno. Up to half the $760 million authorized in the legislation could be spent on federal lands near communities most at risk. Environmentalists agree on the need to thin underbrush and small trees to help prevent wildfires, but they fear the legislation amounts to a gift to the lumber industry. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Sean Cosgrove, the Sierra Club's National Forest Policy Specialist, about why his organization opposes forest initiatives put forward by both Congress and the Bush administration, and about alternative policies that his organization maintains would actually protect both forest communities and old-growth forests.
There's three different things here. There's the proposal that the so-called Healthy Forest Initiative, as proposed by the Bush administration. There's the piece of legislation that was passed by the House in May, and then there was the bill that was taken up by the Senate and voted on last Thursday. The first two, the Bush administration proposal and the House bill, provided no resources for honest fuel reduction around communities, actually doing the real work to reduce wildfire risk around communities, understanding that we're never going to prevent wildfires. They are going to happen. Fires are always going to happen, especially in a place like Southern California. But you can take proactive measures to reduce the risk to homes and communities. The Senate version, as negotiated by Senator Feinstein of California and Senator Wyden of Oregon, along with a couple others, actually did include some funding for real fuel reduction, but I'd say it's a big stretch to say that the bill actually protected old-growth forests. There's a way to protect old-growth forests that this bill does not do. Basically, what's included in this bill is more along the lines of guidelines for logging when in old-growth stands. So it's very different than outright protection for our nation's most ancient and rare and treasured forests.
I know the Sierra Club has had a position for, a number of years, calling for an end to all logging in, is it national forests?
In national forests, yes, on federal public lands.
And how does this bill compare with your organization's priorities?
Well, let's understand that there's a very large difference. There's an exceptionally huge difference between subsidized commercial timber sales, clear cutting of hundreds of thousands of acres of forest for timber corporations, as opposed to removing brush and other flammable material around homes and communities. The two are they're just different as night and day. Sierra Club members in Colorado and other parts of the West have actually engaged with the Forest Service on projects to go out and do this kind of fuel reduction work themselves, actually cutting the brush, hauling it off, chipping it, reducing the flammability factors around homes. That's very different than providing hundreds of millions of dollars each year to subsidize huge corporations to log our national forest. The situation that we have today is that the Bush administration would much rather reduce environmental protections, cut the public out of the process, and increase commercial logging for corporations, as opposed to providing taxpayer funds to go to responsible fuel reduction around communities first.
Does the bill allow for logging in old-growth forests, as well as giving some provision of funding to help remove the kind of fire hazards that you were just describing?
Yeah, the reason why the Sierra Club does not support this bill is that this bill leaves the door wide open to logging in old growth and wild forest areas. Some of our most remote forests that are miles, 20, 50 miles away from communities, are still open to logging under this bill. It's not those forests that need treatment. It's those areas within a quarter mile or a half mile of communities. The other problem with the bill is it does not require enough direct funding. And I'm talking about the Senate version, does not require enough direct funding to do that fuel reduction around communities. And this bill completely is inadequate, is absolutely inadequate in providing the necessary level of funding to do that responsible work. Within what we call the wildland-urban interface, within an area around a half mile around communities, 85% of that land is going to be non-federal. It's not the federal lands that are the most important priority. It's the non-federal lands, the state, county, municipal lands, those kind of things. That's where funding needs to be spent. Now, if you're going to do a good job and the right job in protecting these communities, it's going to take money. If you put the money there in the first place to do fuel reduction, you won't have to spend it later on in fire suppression and hiring air tankers and putting thousands of firefighters on the line. And that's what the Bush administration is missing out on. They'd rather put taxpayer money into subsidies for corporations for commercial logging as opposed to doing fuel reduction around community. Now, there's also several other provisions in the bill that seek to restrict citizens' involvement in the process, that actually seek to interfere with the courts and actually tell judges how they should rule on potential litigation, that agencies should get deference. A number of provisions in this bill, as they came out of the House of Representatives, are basically the same types of things that you're going to see on the timber industry's wish list in the last 10 years. What we'd like to see is a bill that keeps intact environmental protections, obviously, but really directs the funding around communities, requires the agencies to make this the number one job. It needs to be done. The Bush administration is the largest obstacle in the way right now.
That was Sean Cosgrove of the Sierra Club. For more information on pending forest legislation, call the Sierra Club at area code 202-547-1141 or visit their website at www.sierraclub.org. Been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Britta Brundage, Bill Cosentino, Sasha Summer-Cousineau, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.